school, then what? I kicked his ass out. Told him if he couldn't follow the rules of the house, he wasn't living under my roof. That was after his freshman year at the military school. So you know what the little psycho did? Marino reads the display on his pager and gets up. He moves up to Jersey, moves in with Uncle Louie, the fucking mafia. Then has the balls to come back here for school, including law school, William and Mary, so yeah, he's smart as shit.
He passed the bar in Virginia? I ask.
Here, practices all the hell over the place. I ain't seen Rocky in 17 years. Anna, you mind if I make a call? Don't look like I want to be using the cell phone on this one.
He glances at me as he walks out of the living room.
It's Stanfield.
What about the ID he called you about earlier? I ask.
Hopefully what this is about, Marino says. Another real strange one, if it's true.
While he is on the phone, Anna vanishes from her own living room. I supposed she was going to the bathroom, but she does not come back, and I can only imagine how she feels. In many ways, I am more worried about her than about me. I now know enough about her life to appreciate her intense vulnerability and realize the terribly barren, scarred spots on her emotional landscape.
This isn't fair. I begin to lose my composure. It's not fair to anyone.
Everything that has piled up on me begins to unsettle and slide downhill.
Someone please tell me how this happened. Did I do something wrong in a former life? I don't deserve this. None of us do.
Lucy and McGovern listen to me ventilate. They seem to have their own ideas and plans, but are not inclined to offer them right away.
Well, say something, I tell them. Go ahead and let it out.
Mostly I say this for my niece's benefit.
My life is wrecked. I haven't handled anything the way I should. I'm sorry.
Tears threaten.
Right now I want a cigarette. Does anybody have a cigarette?
Marino does, but he is in the kitchen on the phone, and I'll be damned if I'm going to creep in there and interrupt him for a cigarette, as if I need one to begin with.
You know, what hurts me most is to be accused of the very thing I'm so against. I don't abuse power, goddammit. I would never murder somebody in cold blood.
I talk on and on.
I hate death. I hate killing. I hate every goddamn thing I see every goddamn day. And now the world thinks I did something like this? A special grand jury thinks maybe I might have?
I let the questions hang. Neither Lucy nor McGovern responds. Marino is loud. His voice is muscular and big like he is, and tends to shove rather than guide, confront rather than fall in stride.
You sure she's his girlfriend?
He is saying over the telephone. I presume he is speaking to Detective Stanfield.
Versus just friends. Tell me how you know that for a fact.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. What? Do I get it? Hell no, I don't get it. It don't make a shit's worth of sense, Stanfield.
Marino is walking around the kitchen as he talks. He is on the verge of snapping Stanfield's head off.
You know what I tell people like you, Stanfield? Marino snaps. I tell them to get out of my fucking way. I don't give a rat's ass who your fucking brother-in-law is, got it? He can kiss my butt and tuck it in bed, tell it a Betty Bye story.
Stanfield is obviously trying to get in a word or two, but Marino won't let him.
Oh boy, McGovern mutters, returning my attention to the living room, to my own mess.
He's the investigator for these two men who were probably tortured and killed, whoever Marino's talking to? McGovern inquires.
I give her a strange look, as an even stranger sensation ripples through me.
How do you know about the two men who were killed?
I grope for an answer that I must be missing.
McGovern has been in New York. I haven't even autopsied the second John Doe yet. Why does everybody seem to be omniscient all of a sudden? I think of Jamie Berger. I think of Governor Mitchell and Representative Dinwiddie and Anna. A strong breath of fear seems to foul the air like Sean Dunn's body odor, and I imagine I smell him, and my central nervous system has an involuntary reaction. I begin to tremble as if I have drunk a pot of strong coffee, or half a dozen of those heavily sugared Cuban espressos called coladas. I realize I am more afraid than I have ever been in my life, and begin to entertain the unthinkable. Maybe Shan Dun was offering a hint of truth when he persisted in his seemingly absurd claim that he is the victim of some huge political conspiracy. I am paranoid, justifiably. I try to reason with myself. I am, after all, being investigated for the murder of a corrupt policewoman who probably was involved with organized crime. I realize Lucy is talking to me. She has gotten up from her spot before the fire and is pulling a chair close to me. She sits and leans over, touching my good arm as if trying to wake me up. "Aunt Kay," she says. "You with us, Aunt Kay? Are you listening?" I focus on her. Marino is telling Stanfield over the phone that they will meet in the morning. It sounds like a threat. He and I rendezvoused at Phil's for a beer. She glances toward the kitchen, and I remember Marino telling me late this morning that he and Lucy were getting together this afternoon because she had news for him. We know about the guy from the motel. Now she refers to McGovern, who sits very still by the fire, looking at me, waiting to see how I will react when Lucy tells me the rest. "Tian's been here since Saturday," Lucy then says. "When I called you from the Jefferson, remember? Tian was with me. I asked her to get here right away." "Oh," is all I can think to say. "Well, that's good. It bothered me to think of you alone in a hotel." Tears flood my eyes. I am embarrassed and look away from Lucy and McGovern. I am supposed to be strong. I am the one who has always rescued my niece from trouble, most of it of her own making. I have always been the torchbearer who guided her along the right path. I put her through college. I bought her books, her first computer, sent her to any special course she wanted to attend anywhere in the country. I took her to London with me one summer. I have stood up to anyone who tried to interfere with Lucy, including her mother, who has rewarded my efforts with nothing but abuse. "You're supposed to respect me," I say to my niece as I wipe tears with my palm. "How can you any more?" She stands up again and looks down at me. "That's total bullshit," she says with feeling, and now Marino is returning to the living room, another bourbon in hand. "This isn't about my not respecting you," Lucy says. "Jesus Christ. Nobody in the room has any less respect for you, Aunt Kay, but you need help. For once you've got to let other people help you. You sure as hell can't deal with this all by yourself, and maybe you need to sit on your pride a little and let us help, you know? It's not like I'm still 10 years old. I'm 28, okay? I'm not a virgin. I've been an FBI agent, an ATF agent, and am fucking rich. I could be any kind of fucking agent I want." Her wounds inflame before my eyes. She does care about being put on administrative leave. Of course she cares. "And now I'm being my own agent, doing things my own way," she goes on. "I resigned tonight," I tell her. A stunned silence follows. "What did you say?" Marino asks me, standing in front of the fire, drinking. "You did what?"
"I told the governor," I reply, and an inexplicable calm begins to settle over me. It feels good to consider that I did something instead of everything being done to me. Maybe quitting my job makes me less of a victim, if I am willing to finally admit that I am a victim. I suppose I am one, and the only comeback is to finish what Shan Dun started. End my life as I have known it, and start all over. What a weird and stunning thought. I tell Marino, McGovern, and Lucy all about my conversation with Mike Mitchell.
"Hold on." Marino is sitting on the hearth. It is getting close to midnight, and Anna is so quiet I forgot for a moment that she was in the house. Maybe she has gone to bed.
"This mean you can't work cases no more?" Marino says to me.
"Not at all," I reply. "I'll be acting chief until the governor decides otherwise. No one asks me what I plan to do with the rest of my life. It really doesn't make sense to worry about some distant future when the present is shot. I am grateful not to be asked, and probably am sending out my usual signals that I don't want to be asked. People sense when to remain silent, or if nothing else, I deflect their interest, and they don't even realize I have just manipulated them into not probing for information that I prefer to keep to myself. I became an expert at this maneuver at a very young age, when I didn't want my classmates asking me about my father, and if he was still sick, or would ever get better, or what it is like to have your father die. I was conditioned not to tell, and I was conditioned not to ask either. The last 3 years of my father's life were spent in absolute avoidance by my entire family, including him, especially him. He was a lot like Marino, both of them macho Italian men who seemed to assume their bodies will never part company with them, no matter how ill or out of shape. I envision my father as Lucy, Marino, and McGovern talk about all they plan to do and are already doing to help me, including background checks already in the works, and all sorts of things the last precinct has to offer me. I really am not listening. Their voices may as well be the chatter of crows, as I remember the thick Miami grass of my childhood, and dried-out chinch bug husks, and the key lime tree in my small backyard. My father taught me how to crack coconuts on the driveway with a hammer and a screwdriver, and I would spend an inordinate amount of time prying the fleshy, sweet white meat from the hard, hairy shell, and he got a lot of amusement from observing my obsessive labors. The coconut meat would go in the squat white refrigerator, and no one, including me, ever ate it. During blistering summer Saturdays, my father would surprise Dorothy and me now and then by bringing home 2 big blocks of ice from his neighborhood grocery store. We had a small inflatable pool we filled with the hose, and my sister and I would sit on the ice, getting scorched by the sun while we froze our asses off. We would jump in and out of the pool to thaw, then perch on our frigid, slick thrones again like princesses, while my father laughed at us through the living room window, laughed hilariously and tapped on the glass, playing Fats Waller full blast on the hi-fi. My father was a good man. When he felt halfway decent, he was generous, thoughtful, and full of humor and fun. He was handsome, of medium height, blonde and broad-shouldered when he wasn't wasted by cancer. His full name was K. Marcellus Scarpetta III, and he insisted that his firstborn take this name, which has been in the family since Verona. It didn't matter that I happened to arrive first, a girl. K is one of those names that can be assigned to either gender, but my mother has always called me Katie. In part, according to her, it was confusing to have 2 K's in the house. Later, when that was no longer an issue because I was the only K left, she still called me Katie, refusing to accept my father's death, to get over it. And she still isn't over it. She won't let him go. My father died more than 30 years ago when I was 12, and my mother has never gone out with another man. She still wears her wedding band. She still calls me Katie. Lucy and McGovern go over plans until past midnight. They have given up trying to include me in their conversations and no longer even seem to notice that I have slipped away to the old country in my mind, staring into the fire, absently massaging my stiff left hand, and worming a finger under plaster to scratch my miserable, air-starved flesh. Finally, Marino yawns like a bear and pulls himself to his feet. He is made slightly unsteady by bourbon and smells like stale cigarettes, and regards me with a softness in his eyes that I might call sad love, if I were willing to accept his true feelings for me. "Come on," he says to me. "Walk me out to my truck, Doc." This is his way of calling for a treaty between us. Marino is not a brute. He is feeling bad about the way he has been treating me since I was almost murdered, and he has never seen me so distant and strangely quiet. The night is cold and still, and stars are shy behind vague clouds. From Anna's driveway I take in the glow of her many candles in the windows, and am reminded that tomorrow is Christmas Eve, the last Christmas Eve of the 20th century. Keys disturb the peace as Marino unlocks his truck and hesitates awkwardly before opening the driver's door. "We got a lot to do. I'll meet you at the morgue early." This is not what he really wants to say. He stares up at the dark sky and sighs. "Shit, Doc. Look, I've known for a while, okay? By now you've figured that out. I've known what that son of a bitch writer was up to, and I had to let it run its course."
"When were you going to tell me?"
I don't ask this accusingly, simply curiously. He shrugs.
I'm glad Anna brought it up first. I know you didn't kill Diane Bray, for God's sake. But I wouldn't blame you if you had, truth be told. She was the biggest fucking bitch ever born. In my book, if you'd done her in, it would have been damn self-defense.
Well, it wouldn't have been. I addressed the possibility seriously. It wouldn't have been, Marino. And I didn't kill her.
I looked closely at his hulking shape in the cast-off of carriage lamps and holiday lights in trees.
You've never really thought.
I don't finish the question. Maybe I really don't want to know his answer.
Hell, I'm not sure what I've been thinking lately, he says. That's the truth. But what am I going to do, Doc?
Do? About what?
I don't know what he means.
He shrugs and gets choked up.
I can't believe it.
Marino is about to cry.
If you quit...
His voice rises, and he clears his throat and fumbles for his lucky strikes. He cups his huge hands around my hand and lights a cigarette for me, his skin rough against mine, the hairs on the back of his wrists whispering against my chin. He smokes, staring off, heartbroken.
Then what? I'm supposed to go down to the fucking morgue and you ain't there anymore? Hell, I wouldn't go down to that stinkhole half as much as I do if it wasn't for you being there, Doc. You're the only damn thing that gives any life to that joint, no kidding.
I hug him. I barely come up to his chest, and his belly separates the beat of our hearts. He has raised his own barriers in this life, and I'm overwhelmed by an immeasurable compassion and need for him. I pat his broad chest and let him know. We've been together for a long time, Marino. You're not rid of me yet.
Chapter 21. Teeth have their own stories. Your dental habits often reveal more about you than jewelry or designer clothes, and can identify you to the exclusion of all others, providing you have pre-mortem records for comparison. Teeth tell me about your hygiene. They whisper secrets about drug abuse, early childhood antibiotics, disease, injury, and how important your appearance was to you. They confess if your dentist was a crook and billed your insurance company for work that was never done. They tell me, for that matter, if your dentist was competent. Marino meets me at the morgue before daylight the next morning. He has in hand the dental records of a 22-year-old James City County man who went out jogging yesterday near the campus of William and Mary and never returned home. His name is Mitch Barbosa. William and Mary is but a few miles from the Fort James Motel, and when Marino talked to Stanfield last night and was given this latest information, my first thought was, how odd. Marino's shifty attorney's son, Rocky Caggiano, went to William and Mary. Life offers up yet one more eerie coincidence. It is 6:45 when I roll the body out of the X-ray room and over to my station inside the autopsy suite. Again, it is quiet. It is Christmas Eve, and all state offices are closed. Marino is suited up to assist me, and I don't expect another living person, except the forensic dentist, to show up here right now. Marino's part will be to help me undress the stiff, unwilling body and lift it to and from the autopsy table. I would never allow him to assist in any medical procedure, not that he has ever volunteered. I have never asked him to scribe, and won't, because his slaughter of Latin medical words and terms is remarkable.
Hold him on either side, I direct Marino.
Good. Just like that.
Marino grips either side of the dead man's head, trying to hold it still as I work a thin chisel into the side of the mouth, sliding it between molars to pry open the jaws. Steel scrapes against enamel. I am careful not to cut the lips, but it is inevitable that I chip the surfaces of the back teeth.
It's just a damn good thing people are dead when you do shit like this to them, Marino says. Bet you'll be glad when you got two hands again.
Don't remind me. I am so sick of my cast, I have had thoughts of cutting it off myself with a striker saw.
The dead man's jaws give up and open,
and I turn on the surgical lamp and fill the inside of his mouth with white light. There are fibers on his tongue, and I collect them. Marino helps me break the rigor mortis in the arms so we can get the jacket and shirt off, and then I take off shoes and socks, and finally the warm-up pants and running shorts. I perk him and find no evidence of injury to his anus, nothing so far to suggest homosexual activity. Marino's pager goes off. It is Stanfield again. Marino has not said a word about Rocky this morning, but the specter of him hovers. Rocky is in the air, and the effect this has on his father is subtle but profound. A heavy, helpless anguish radiates from Marino like body heat. I should be worried about what Rocky has in store for me, but all I can think about is what will happen to Marino. Now that my patient is naked before me, I take in the full picture of who he was physically. He is 5'7" and a lean 138 pounds. He has muscular legs, but little muscle development in his upper body, which is consistent with a runner. He has no tattoos, is circumcised, and clearly cared about his grooming, based on his neatly manicured fingernails and toenails and clean-shaven face. So far I find no evidence of injury externally, and X-rays reveal no projectiles, no fractures. He has old scars on his knees and left elbow, but nothing fresh, except the abrasions from being bound and gagged. "What happened to you? Why did you die?" He remains silent. Only Marino is talking in a blunt, loud way to disguise how unsettled he is. He thinks Stanfield is a dolt and treats him as such. Marino is more impatient, more insulting than usual.
"Yeah, well, it sure would be nice if we knew that," Marino blasts sarcasm into the wall phone. "Death don't take no holiday," he adds a moment later. "You tell whoever I'm coming and they will let me in." Then, yeah, 'tis the season. "And Stanfield, keep your mouth shut, okay? You got that? I read about this in the goddamn paper one more time." "Oh, really? Well, maybe you didn't see the Richmond paper yet. I'll make sure and tear out this morning's article for you. All this Jamestown shit, hate crime shit. One more peep and I'm gonna get tear ass. You never seen me tear ass, and you don't want to."
Marino pulls on fresh gloves as he returns to the gurney, his gown flapping around his legs.
"Well, it just gets more squirrely, Doc. Assuming this guy here's our disappeared jogger, it appears we're dealing with a garden-variety truck driver. No record, no trouble. Lived in a condo with a girlfriend who's ID'd him by photo. That's who Stanfield talked to late last night, apparently, but she ain't answering the phone so far this morning."
He gets a lost look on his face, not certain how much he has already told me. "Let's get him on the table," I say. I parallel park the gurney next to the autopsy table. Marino gets the feet, I grab an arm, and we pull. The body bangs against steel, and blood trickles from the nose. I turn on water, and it drums into the steel sink, the dead man's X-rays glowing from light boxes on the wall, revealing perfectly pristine bones, and the skull from different angles, and the zipper of the warm-up jacket snaking down each side of gracefully bowed ribs. The buzzer sounds out in the bay as I run a scalpel from shoulder to shoulder, then down to the pelvis, making a small detour around the navel. I observe Dr. Sam Terry's image on closed-circuit TV and hit a button with my elbow to open the bay door. He is one of our odontologists, or forensic dentists, whose bad luck it is to be on call Christmas Eve.
"I'm thinking we need to drop by and pay her a visit while we're in the area," Marino goes on. "I got her address, the girlfriend, the condo where they live."
He glances down at the body.
"Lived, I guess."
"And you think Stanfield can keep his mouth shut?" I reflect back tissue with staccato cuts of the scalpel, awkwardly gripping forceps in the gloved fingertips of my plaster-bound left hand.
"Yeah. Says he'll meet us at the motel, which ain't being real friendly, moaning and groaning it's Christmas Eve, and they don't want any more attention because it's already hurt their business. Something like 10 cancellations because of people hearing about it on the news. Yeah, like bullshit is what I say. Most of the people who stay in that dump probably don't know shit about what's happened around here, or care.
Dr. Terry walks in, his scuffed black doctor's bag in hand, a fresh surgical gown untied in back and billowing as he heads to the counter. He is our youngest and newest odontologist, and is almost 7 feet tall. Legend has it that he could have had a career with the NBA, but wanted to continue his education. The truth, and he'll tell you if you ask, is he was a mediocre guard at Virginia Commonwealth University, that the only good shooting he has ever done is with guns, the only good rebounding is with women, and he only went into dentistry because he couldn't get into medical school. Terry desperately wanted to be a forensic pathologist. What he's doing as basically a volunteer is as close as he will ever get. "Thank you, thank you," I tell him as he begins arranging his paperwork on a clipboard. "You are a good man to come help us out this morning, Sam." He grins, then jerks his head at Marino and says in his most exaggerated New Jersey accent,
"How you doing, Marino? You ever seen the Grinch steal Christmas? 'Cause if you haven't, just hang out with me for a while. I'm in a mood to take back little kids' toys and pat their mamas on the ass on my way up the chimney." "Don't you be trying to go up no chimneys. You'll get stuck for sure. Hell, you could look out the top of a chimney and still have your feet in the fireplace. You still growing?" "Not as much as you are, man. What you weighing in these days?"
Terry thumbs through the dental charts Marino brought in.
"Well, this won't take long. He's got a rotated right maxillary second premolar, the distal surface lingual, and lots of restorations. Saying this guy," he holds up the charts, "and your guy are one and the same." "How about them Rams beating Louisville?" Marino calls out above the drumming of running water. "Were you there?" "Nope, and you wasn't either, Terry, which is why they won." "Probably true."
I pluck a surgical knife off the cart as the phone rings. "Sam, you mind getting that?" I ask. He trots to the corner, snaps up the phone, and announces,
"Morgue."
I cut through the costochondral cartilage junctions, removing a triangle of sternum and parasternal ribs.
"Hold on," Terry says to whoever has him on the line.
"Dr. Scarpetta, can you talk to Benton Wesley?"
The room becomes a vacuum that sucks out all light and sound. I freeze, staring, stunned, the steel surgical knife poised in my bloody gloved right hand.
"What the fuck?"
Marino blurts out. He strides over to Terry and snatches the phone from him.
"Who the hell is this?"
he yells into the mouthpiece.
"Shit!"
He tosses the receiver back into the cradle on the wall. Obviously the person hung up. Terry looks stricken. He has no idea what just happened. He hasn't known me long. There is no reason for him to know about Benton unless someone else told him, and apparently no one has.
"What exactly did the person say to you?" Marino asks Terry.
"I hope I didn't do something wrong."
"No, no," I find my voice. "You didn't," I reassure him.
"Some man," he replies. "All he said is he wanted to speak to you, and he said his name was Benton Wesley."
Marino picks up the phone again and swears and fumes because there is no caller ID. We have never had occasion to need caller ID in the morgue. He hits several buttons and listens. He writes down a number and dials it.
"Yeah, who's this?"
he demands over the line to whoever has picked up.
"Where? Okay. You see someone else using this phone just a minute ago? The one you're talking on?" "Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I don't believe you, asshole."
He slams down the receiver.
"You think it's the same one who just called?" Terry asks him in confusion. "What did you do? Hit star 69? "A payphone. At the Texaco on Midlothian Turnpike, supposedly. I don't know if it's the same person who called." "What was his voice like?"
Marino pins Terry with a stare.
"He sort of sounded young, I think. I don't know. Who's Benton Wesley?"
"He's dead." I reach for the scalpel, pushing the point down on a cutting board, snapping in a new blade and dropping the old in a bright red biohazard plastic container. He was a friend, a close friend.
Some squirrel playing a sick joke. How would anybody know the number down here?
Marino is upset. He is furious. He wants to find the caller and pound him, and he is considering that his malevolent son may be behind this. I can read it in Marino's eyes. He is thinking about Rocky. Under state government listings in the phone book, I begin cutting blood vessels, severing the carotids very low at the apex, moving down to the iliac arteries and veins of the pelvis.
Don't tell me it says morgue in the goddamn phone book!
Marino starts up his old routine again. He is blaming me. I think it's listed under funeral information. I cut through the thin, flat muscle of the diaphragm, loosening the block of organs, freeing it from the vertebral column. Lungs, liver, heart, kidneys, and spleen shimmer different hues of red as I lay the block on the cutting board and wash off blood with a gentle hosing of cold water. I notice petechial hemorrhages, dark areas of bleeding no bigger than pinpricks scattered over the heart and lungs. I associate this with persons who had difficulty breathing at or about the time of death. Terry carries his black bag over to my station and sets it on the surgical cart. He gets out a dental mirror and goes inside the dead man's mouth. We work in silence, the weight of what has just occurred pressing down hard. I reach for a bigger knife and cut sections of organs, slicing through the heart. The coronary arteries are open and clear, the left ventricle 1 centimeter wide, the valves normal. Other than a few fatty streaks in the aorta, the heart and vessels are healthy. The only thing wrong with it is the obvious. It quit. For some reason, this man's heart stopped. I find no explanation anywhere I look.
Like I said, this one's easy, Terry says as he makes notes on a chart. His voice is nervous. He wishes he had never answered the phone.
He's our guy? I ask him.
Sure is.
The carotid arteries lie like rails in the neck. Between them are the tongue and neck muscles, which I flip down and peel away so I can examine them closely on the cutting board. There are no hemorrhages in deep tissue. The tiny, fragile, U-shaped hyoid bone is intact. He wasn't strangled. When I reflect back his scalp, I find no contusions or fractures hiding underneath. I plug a striker saw into the overhead cord reel and realize I need more than one hand. Terry helps me steady the head as I push the whining, vibrating, semicircular blade through the skull. Hot, bony dust drifts on the air, and the skull cap lifts off with a soft, sucking sound, revealing the convoluted horizon of the brain. On gross examination, there is nothing wrong with it. Slices gleam like creamy agate with gray, ruffled edges as I rinse them on the cutting board. I will save the brain and heart for further special studies, fixing them in formalin and sending them to the Medical College of Virginia. My diagnosis this morning is one of exclusion. Having found no obvious pathological cause of death, I am left with one that is based on whispers. Tiny hemorrhages on heart and lungs, and burns and abrasions from bondage suggest Mitch Barbosa died from stress-induced arrhythmia. I also postulate that at some point he was holding his breath, or his airway was obstructed, or for some reason his breathing was compromised to the extent that he partially asphyxiated. Perhaps the gag, which would have gotten wet from saliva, is to blame. Whatever the truth, I am getting a picture that is simple and ghastly and calls for demonstration. Terry and Marino are handy. First, I cut off several lengths of the thick white twine that we routinely use to suture up Y incisions. I tell Marino to push up the sleeves of his surgical gown and hold out his hands. I tie one segment of twine around one wrist and a second strand around the other, not too tight, but snug. I instruct him to hold his arms up in the air and direct Terry to grab the loose ends of twine and pull up. Terry is tall enough to do this without a chair or footstool. The bindings immediately dig into the underside of Marino's wrists and are angled up toward the knots. We try this in different positions, with variations of the arms close together and spread wide, crucifixion style. Of course, Marino's feet remain squarely on the floor. In no instance is he hanging or even dangling. The weight of a body on outstretched arms interferes with exhalation, I explain. You can inhale, but it's difficult exhaling because the intercostal muscles are compromised. Over a period of time, this would lead to asphyxia. You add that to the shock of pain from torture, you add fear and panic, and you could certainly suffer from an arrhythmia. What about the nosebleed? Marino holds out his wrists, and I examine the indentations the twine has left in his skin. They are angled up similarly to those on the dead man. Increased intracranial pressure, I say. In a breath-holding situation, you can get nosebleeds. In the absence of injury, that's a good guess. My question is whether someone meant to kill him? Terry poses. Most people aren't going to string someone up and torture him and then let him go to tell the story, I reply. I'll pend his cause and manner for now until we see what Tox has to say. My eyes light on Marino's. But I believe you best treat this as a homicide, a very awful one. We contemplate this later in the morning as we drive toward James City County. Marino wanted to take his truck, and I suggested we follow Route 5 east along the river, through Charles City County, where 18th-century plantations fan out from the roadside in vast fallow fields that lead to the awesome brick mansions and outbuildings of Sherwood Forest, Westover, Berkeley, Shirley, and Bel Air. There isn't a tour bus in sight, no logging trucks or road work, and country stores are closed. It is Christmas Eve. The sun shines through endless arches of old trees. Shadows dapple pavement, and Smokey the Bear asks for help from a sign in a gracious part of the world where two men have died barbarically. It does not seem that anything so heinous could happen here until we get to the Fort James Motel and campground. Tucked off Route 5 in the woods, it is a hodgepodge of cabins, trailers, and motel buildings that are rusting and paint-peeled, reminding me of Hogan's Alley at the FBI Academy, cheaply constructed facades where shady people are about to get raided by the law. The rental office is in a small frame house overwhelmed by scrubby pines that have carpeted the roof and earth in brown tags. Soft drink and ice machines in front glow through overgrown bushes. Children's bicycles lie wounded in leaves, and ancient seesaws and swings aren't to be trusted. A homely mixed-breed dog that sags with a history of chronic breeding rises to her old feet and stares at us from the sloping porch. I thought Stanfield was meeting us here. I open my door. Go figure. Marino climbs out of the truck, his eyes moving everywhere. A veil of smoke drifts out the chimney and streams almost horizontally with the wind, and through a window I catch winking, gaudy Christmas lights. I feel eyes on us. A curtain moves, the sounds of a television muted from deep within the house as we wait on the porch and the dog sniffs my hand and licks me. Marino announces our arrival with a fist pounding the door and finally calls out, "Anybody home? Hey!" banging his fist hard. "Police!"
I'm coming,"
an impatient woman's voice sings out. A hard, tired face fills the space of the opening door, the burglar chain still anchored and taut.
"You Mrs. Kiffin?" Marino asks her.
"Who are you?"
she asks him back.
"Captain Marino, Richmond P.D. This is Dr. Scarpetta."
"What you bringing a doctor for?"
Brow furrowing, she glances at me from her shadowy crack. A stirring at her feet, and a child peeks out at us and smiles like an imp.
"Zack, you go back inside."
Small bare arms, hands with dirty nails wrap around Mama's knee. She shakes him loose.
"Go on!"
He disconnects and is gone.
"Going to need you to show us the room where the fire was," Marino tells her. "Detective Stanfield with James City County should be here. You seen him?"
"No police been here this morning."
She pushes the door shut, and the burglar chain rattles as she removes it, Then the door opens again, this time wide, and she steps out on the porch, pushing her arms into the sleeves of a lumberjack's red plaid coat, a ring of keys jingling in her hand. She yells into the house,
"Y'all stay! Zack, don't you get into the cookie dough. I'll be right back."
She shuts the door.
"Never seen anybody love cookie dough like that boy," she tells us as we go down the steps. "Sometimes I buy the pre-made in rolls, and one day I catch Zack eating one, wrapper peeled down like a banana. Ate half of it by the time I caught him. I told him, 'You know what's in it? Raw eggs, that's what.'"
Bev Kiffin is probably no more than 45, her prettiness hard and garish like truck stop cafes and late-night diners. Her hair is dyed bright blonde and is curly like a French poodle, her dimples deep, her figure ripe on the way to matronly. She has a defensive, obstinate air about her that I associate with people who are used to being worn down and in trouble. I would also call her shifty. I am about to distrust every word she says.
"I don't want problems out here," she lets us know. "As if I don't have enough going on, especially this time of year," she says as she walks. "All these people pulling in here morning, noon, and night to gawk and take pictures."
"What people?" Marino asks her.
"Just people in cars pulling up in the drive, staring. Some of them getting out and roaming around. Last night I woke up when someone drove through. It was 2 a.m.
Marino lights a cigarette. We follow Kiffin through the shade of pines along an overgrown path of churned-up snow, past old campers that list like unseaworthy ships. Near a picnic table is a nest of personal belongings that at first glance look like trash from a campsite someone didn't clean up. But then I see the unexpected, an odd collection of toys, dolls, paperback books, sheets, two pillows, a blanket, a double baby carriage, items that are soggy and dirty not because they were worthless and deliberately pitched, but because they have been inadvertently exposed to the elements. Scattered throughout are shredded plastic wrappers that instantly connect with the fragment I found clinging to the first victim's burned back. The fragments are white, blue, and bright orange, and are ripped in narrow strips, as if whoever did it has a nervous habit of picking things to pieces.
"Someone sure left in a hurry," Marino comments.
Kiffin is watching me.
"Maybe skipped without settling the bill," Marino says.
"Oh, no."
She seems in a hurry to move on to the small, tawdry motel showing through trees ahead.
"They paid up front like everyone else. A family with two little ones staying in a tent, and all of a sudden they hightailed it out of here. Don't know why they left all that. Some of it, like the baby buggy's pretty nice. Course, then it snowed on everything."
A gust of wind scatters several bits of wrappers like confetti. I wander closer and nudge a pillow with my foot, turning it over. A pungent, sour odor rises to my nostrils as I squat and take a closer look. Clinging to the underside of the pillow is hair. Long, pale hair, very fine hair that has no pigmentation. My heart thuds like the sudden, unexpected kick of a bass drum. I move the shredded wrappers around with my finger. The plasticized material is pliable but tough, so it doesn't tear easily unless you start at a crinkled edge where the wrapper was heat-sealed together. Some of the fragments are large and easily recognizable as having come from Payday peanut caramel candy bars. I can even make out the website address for Hershey's chocolate. More hair on the blanket. Short, dark hair. A pubic hair. And several more of the long, pale hairs. "Payday candy bars," I say to Marino. I look at Kiffin as I open my satchel. "Know anybody out here who eats a lot of payday candy bars and picks apart the wrappers?"
"Well, it didn't come from my house."
As if we have accused her, or maybe Zack and his sweet tooth. I do not carry my aluminum crime scene case to scenes where there is no body, but I always keep an emergency kit in my satchel. A heavy-duty freezer bag filled with disposable gloves, evidence bags, swabs, a tiny vial of distilled water and gunshot residue GSR kits, among other items. I remove the cap from a GSR kit. It is nothing more than a small, clear plastic stub with an adhesive tip that I use to collect 3 hairs from the pillow and 2 from the blanket. I seal the stub and the hairs inside a small, transparent plastic evidence bag.
"You don't mind my asking?" Kiffin says to me. "What are you doing that for?"
"Think I'll just bag all this crap, the whole campsite, and take it into the labs."
Marino is suddenly low-key, calm like a seasoned poker player. He knows how to handle Kiffin, and now she has to be handled, because he also knows all too well that hypertrichotic people have unique hair, fine, unpigmented, rudimentary, baby-like hair. Only baby hair is not 6 or 7 inches long, like the hair Chandon shed at his crime scenes. It is possible that Jean-Baptiste Chandon has been to this campground.
"You manage this place by yourself?" Marino asks Kiffin.
"Pretty much."
"When did the family in the tent leave? It's not exactly tent weather."
"They were here right before it snowed. Late last week."
"You ever find out why they left in such a hurry?"
Marino keeps probing in his bland tone.
"Haven't heard from them. Not a word."
"We're going to need to take a better look at what all they left behind."
Kiffin blows on her bare hands to warm them and hugs herself, turning away from the wind. She looks back at her house, and you can almost see her contemplating what kind of trouble life holds for her and her family this time. Marino motions for me to follow him.
"Wait here," he tells Kiffin. "We'll be right back. Just gonna get something out of my truck. Don't touch nothing, all right?"
She watches us walk off. Marino and I talk in low voices. Hours before Chandon appeared at my front door, Marino was out with the response team searching for him, and they discovered where he was hiding in Richmond in the mansion under major renovation on the James River, very close to my neighborhood. Since he rarely, if ever, went out during daylight hours, we assume, his comings and goings went undetected as he hid in the house and helped himself to whatever was there. Until this moment, it never occurred to any of us that Chandon might have stayed any place else.
"You think he scared off whoever was in that tent so he could use it?"
Marino unlocks his truck and reaches in the back of the cab, where I know, for one thing, he keeps a pump-action shotgun.
"Because I gotta tell you, Doc, something we noticed when we went inside that house on the James was junk food wrappers everywhere. A lot of candy bar wrappers."
He lifts out a red toolbox and shuts the door of the truck.
"Like he's got a real sugar thing."
"Do you remember what kind of junk food?" "I remember all the Pepsis Chandon drank while Berger was interviewing him."
"Snickers bars. I don't remember if they were paydays, but candy, peanuts. Those little bags of Planters peanuts. And now that I think of it, the wrappers were all tore up."
"Christ," I mutter, suddenly chilled to the marrow. "I wonder if he might have low blood sugar." I try to be clinical, to regain my balance. Fear returns like a swarm of bats.
"What the hell was he doing out here?" Marino says,
and he keeps staring in the direction of Kiffin in the distance, making sure she isn't tampering with anything in a campsite that has now become part of a crime scene.
"And how the hell did he get here? Maybe he did have a car."
"Any vehicles at the house where he was hiding?" I ask, as Kiffin watches our return, a solitary figure in red plaid, breath emerging in smoky puffs.
"The people that owned the mansion, they didn't keep any cars there while all the work was going on,"
Marino tells me in a voice Kiffin can't hear.
"Maybe he stole something and kept it parked somewhere it wasn't going to be noticed. I just assumed the squirrel didn't even know how to drive, seeing as how he pretty much lived in the dungeon in his family's house in Paris."
"Yes, more assumptions," I mutter, remembering Chandon's claiming he drove one of those green motorcycles to clean Paris sidewalks, doubting the story but not much else any longer. We are back at the picnic table, and Marino sets down the toolbox and opens it. He gets out leather work gloves and puts them on, then shakes open several 50-gallon heavy-duty garbage bags, and I hold them open. We fill 3 bags, and he cuts open a 4th and drapes sections of black plastic over the baby carriage and tapes them together. While he is doing this, he explains to Kiffin that it is possible someone scared off the family who was staying in this tent. He suggests that maybe a stranger claimed squatter's rights at this site, even if for only a night. Did she at any point have a sense of anything out of the ordinary, including an unfamiliar vehicle in the area prior to last Saturday? He poses all this as if it would never occur to him that she would tarnish the truth. We know, of course, that Sean Dunn could not have been here after Saturday. He has been in custody since then. Kiffin is no help. She claims she was aware of nothing out of the ordinary except that early one morning she went out for firewood and noticed the tent was gone, but the family's belongings were still here, or at least part of them. She can't swear to it, but the more Marino prods her, the more she believes she noticed the tent gone around 8 a.m. last Friday. Sean Dunn murdered Diane Bray on Thursday night. Did he then flee afterward to James City County to hide? I imagine him appearing at the tent, a couple and their small children inside. One look at him, and it is believable they would have jumped into their car and sped off without bothering to pack. We carry the trash bags to Marino's truck and put them in back. Again, Kiffin awaits our return, hands in the pockets of her jacket, her face rosy from the cold. The motel is straight ahead through pine trees, a small boxy white structure, two stories with doors painted the color of evergreens. Behind the motel are more woods, then a wide creek that branches off from the James River.
"How many people you got staying here right now?" Marino asks the woman who runs this dreadful tourist trap.
"Right now? Maybe 13, depending on whether anybody else has checked out. A lot of people just leave their key in the room, and I don't know they're gone until I go in to clean up."
"You know, I left my cigarettes in the house," she says to Marino without looking at him. "You mind?" Marino sets down his toolbox on the path. He shakes a cigarette loose from the pack and lights it for her. Her upper lip crinkles like crepe paper when she sucks in smoke, inhaling deeply and blowing out one side of her mouth. My lust for tobacco stirs. My fractured elbow complains about the cold. I can't stop thinking about the family in the tent and their terror. If it is true that Sean Dunn showed up and the family exists, if he did come directly here after murdering Bray, what happened to his clothes? He had to have gotten blood all over himself. Did he leave Bray's house and come out here covered with blood and frighten strangers out of their tent, and no one called the police or said a word to anyone?
"How many people were staying here night before last when the fire started?"
Marino picks up his toolbox, and we start walking again.
"I know how many were checked in." She is vague. "Don't know who was still here. 11 had checked in, including him."
"Including the man who died in the fire?" It is my turn to ask questions. Kiffin throws a look at me.
"That's right."
"Tell me about his checking in," Marino says to her as we walk and pause to look around, and then walk on. "You just see him drive up like we just did? Appears to me cars just pull right up to the front of your house."
She starts shaking her head.
"No, sir. Didn't see no car. There was a knock on the door, and I opened it. Told him to go next door to the office, and I'd meet him there. He was a nice-looking man, well-dressed. Didn't look like the usual I get. That much stands out clear as day."
"He tell you his name?" Marino asks her.
"Paid cash."
"So if someone pays cash, you don't get them to fill out nothing?"
"Can if they want. Don't have to. I have a registration pad you can fill out, and then I tear off the receipt."
"He said he didn't need a receipt." "He have an accent or anything?"
"He didn't sound like he was from these parts."
"Could you place where he sounded from? Northern? Maybe foreign?"
Marino keeps on as we pause again beneath pines. She looks around, thinking and smoking as we follow her along a muddy path that leads to the motel parking lot.
"Not deep south," she decides. "But he didn't sound like he was from a foreign country. You know, he didn't say much. Said as little as he had to. I got a feeling, you know. Like he was in a hurry and sort of nervous, and he sure wasn't chatty."
This sounds completely fabricated. Her tone of voice actually changes.
"Anybody staying in these campers?" Marino then asks.
"I rent 'em out. People don't come with their own campers right now.
It's off-season for camping.
Anybody renting them now?
No, nobody. In front of the motel, a chair with ripped upholstery has been placed near a Coke machine and payphone. There are several cars in the lot, American-made, not new. A Granada, an LTD, a Firebird. There is no sign of whoever might own them.
Who do you get this time of year? I inquire.
A mixture, Kiffin goes on as we cross the parking lot to the south end of the building. I scan wet asphalt.
Folks who aren't getting along. That's a lot of it this time of year. People fussing and one or the other walks out or gets kicked out and needs a place to stay. Or people driving a long distance to visit family need a place for the night. Or when the river floods, like it did a couple months back, some people come here because I allow pets. And I get tourists.
People seeing Williamsburg and Jamestown? I ask.
A fair number of people here to see Jamestown. That's picked up quite a bit since they started digging up the graves out there. Funny how people are.
Chapter 22. Room 17 is on the first level at the very end. Crime scene tape is a bright yellow ribbon across the door. The location is remote, at the edge of thick woods that buffer the motel from Route 5. I am especially interested in any vegetation or debris that might be on the asphalt directly in front of the room, where rescuers would have dragged the body. I note dirt and bits of dead leaves and cigarette butts. I am wondering if the fragment of candy bar wrapper I found adhering to the dead man's back came from inside the room or from out here in the parking lot. If it came from inside the room, that could mean the killer tracked it in, or it could mean that the killer walked through or close to the abandoned campsite at some point prior to the murder, unless the bit of paper had been inside the room for a while, perhaps tracked in by Kiffin herself when she came in to clean after the last guest checked out. Evidence is tricky. You always have to consider its origin and not draw conclusions based on where the evidence ended up. Fibers on a body, for example, might have been transferred from the killer, who picked them up from a carpet where they were deposited originally by someone who tracked them into a house after yet another individual left them on a car seat.
Did he ask for a particular room? I ask Kiffin as she goes through keys on the ring.
Said he wanted something private. 17 didn't have anybody on either side or above, so that's what I gave him.
What did you do to your arm?
Slipped on ice.
Oh, that's too bad. You got to wear that cast a long time?
Not much longer.
You get the sense he might have had anybody with him? Marino asks her.
Didn't see anybody else.
She speaks tersely with Marino, but is friendlier toward me. I feel her glancing at my face frequently and have the sinking feeling she has seen my photograph in the papers or on television.
What kind of doctor did you say you are?
She quizzes me. I'm a medical examiner.
Oh, she brightens. Like Quincy. Used to love that show. You remember that one where he could tell everything about a person from one bone?
She turns the key in the lock and opens the door, and the air turns acrid with the dirty stench of fire.
I just thought that was the most amazing thing. Race, gender, even what he did for a living and how big he was, and exactly when and how he died all from one little bone.
The door opens wide onto a scene that is as dark and filthy as a coal mine.
"Can't tell you how much this is going to cost me," she says as we move past her and step inside. "Insurance won't ever cover something like this. Never does. Damn insurance companies."
"I'm going to need you to wait outside," Marino says to Kiffin. The only light is what spills through the open doorway, and I make out the shape of the double bed. In the center of it is a crater where the mattress burned down to the bedsprings. Marino turns on a flashlight and a long finger of light moves through the room, starting with the closet just right of where I am standing near the doorway. Two bent wire hangers dangle from the wooden rod. The bathroom is just left of the door, and against the wall opposite the bed is a dresser. Something is on top of the dresser, a book. It is open. Marino walks closer to illuminate the pages.
Gideon Bible, he says.
The light moves on to the far end of the room, where there are two chairs and a small table before a window and a back door.
Marino opens the curtains, and wan sunlight seeps into the room. The only fire damage I can see is to the bed, which smoldered and produced a lot of dense smoke. Everything inside the room is covered with soot, and this is an unexpected forensic gift. The entire room's been smoked, I marvel out loud. Huh? Marino shines the light around as I dig out my portable phone. I see no evidence that Stanfield tried looking for latent prints in here. Not that I blame him. Most investigators would assume the intense soot and smoke damage would obliterate fingerprints, when in fact the opposite is true. Heat and soot tend to process latent prints, and there is an old laboratory method called smoking used on non-porous objects such as shiny metals, which tend to have a Teflon effect when traditional dusting powders are applied. Latent prints are actually transferred to an object because the friction ridge surfaces of fingers and palms have oily residues on them. It is these residues that end up on some surface, a doorknob, a drinking glass, a window pane. Heat softens the residues, and smoke and soot then adhere to them. During cooling, the residues become fixed or firm, and the soot can be gently brushed away like dusting powder. Before superglue fuming and alternate light sources, it was not uncommon to conjure up prints by burning tarry pine chips, camphor, and magnesium. It is very possible that beneath the patina of soot in this room, there is a galaxy of latent fingerprints that have already been processed for us. I call Fingerprints Section Chief Niels Vander at home and explain the situation, and he says he will meet us at the motel in 2 hours. Marino is caught up in other preoccupations, his attention fixated on some spot above the bed, where he is shining the light. "Holy shit," he mutters. "Doc, would you look at this?" He illuminates 2 sooty eye bolts screwed into the drywall ceiling about 3 feet apart.
"Hey!"
he calls through the doorway to Kiffin. She peers inside the room and looks where he shines the light.
"You got any idea why these bolts are in the ceiling?" he asks her.
She gets a strange expression on her face, her voice going up a note, the way it does when she is being evasive, I think.
"Never seen them before. Now I wonder how that happened," she declares.
"Last time you were in this room was when?" Marino asks her.
"A couple days before he checked in, when I cleaned it after the last person checked out. The last person before him, I mean."
"The bolts weren't here then?"
"I didn't notice if they were."
"Mrs. Kiffin, you just hang outside there in case we got more questions."
Marino and I put on gloves. He splays his fingers, rubber stretching and snapping. The window next to the back door overlooks a swimming pool that is filled with dirty water. Across from the bed is a small Zenith television on a stand, a note taped to it reminding guests to turn the TV off before they go out. The room is rather much what Stanfield described, but he did not mention the Gideon Bible open on the dresser, or that to the right of the bed near the floor there is an electrical outlet with 2 unplugged cords on the carpet next to it, one to the lamp on the bedside table, the other to the clock radio. The clock radio is old. It isn't digital. When it was unplugged, the hands stopped at 3:12 p.m. Marino tells Kiffin to step inside the room again.
"What time did you say he checked in?" he asks.
"Oh, round 3.
She is just inside the doorway, staring blankly at the clock.
"Looks like he came in and unplugged the clock and the lamp now, doesn't it? That's kind of strange, unless maybe he was plugging something else in and needed the outlet. Some of these business types have those laptop computers."
"Did you notice if he had one?"
Marino glances at her.
"I didn't notice he had anything except what looked like a car key in his wallet."
"You didn't say nothing about a wallet. You saw a wallet?"
"Pulled it out to pay me. Black leather, as I recall. Expensive looking, like everything else he had. Might have been alligator or something," she adds to her story.
"How much cash he pay you, and in what kind of bills?"
$100 bill and 4 20s. He told me to keep the change. The total was $160.70.
"Oh, yeah, the 1607 special," Marino says in a monotone.
He doesn't like Kiffin,
He certainly doesn't trust her worth a damn, but he keeps it to himself, playing her like a hand of cards. If I didn't know him so well, he might fool even me.
"You got some kind of stepladder around here?" Marino says next.
She hesitates. "Well, I guess so." She is gone again, the door left standing wide open. Marino gets down to take a closer look at the outlet and unplugged cords.
"You think they plugged the heat gun in here?"
He ponders this out loud. "It's possible. If we're talking about a heat gun," I remind him.
"I've used them to thaw my pipes and to get ice off my front steps. Works like a charm."
He is looking under the bed with the flashlight.
"Never had a case where one was used on a person. Jesus. He must have been gagged pretty good for no one to hear anything. Wonder why they unplugged both things, the lamp and the clock.
Maybe so it didn't throw the circuit breaker?
In a joint like this, yeah, maybe. A heat gun's probably about the same voltage as a blow dryer, 120, 125, and a blow dryer would probably knock out the lights in a dump like this."
I move over to the dresser and look at the Bible. It is open to the 6th and 7th chapters of Ecclesiastes, and the exposed pages are sooty, the area of dresser under the Bible spared, indicating this was the position the Bible was in when the fire started. The question is whether the Bible was open like this before the victim checked in, or does it even belong with the room, for that matter? My eyes wander down lines and stop at the first verse of the 7th chapter. "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth." I read it to Marino. I tell him that this section of Ecclesiastes is about vanity.
"Kind of fits with the queer thing, don't it?"
he comments, as aluminum scrapes outside and Kiffin returns with a rush of wintry air. Marino takes a paint-spattered bent ladder from her and opens the legs. He climbs up and shines the flashlight on the bolts.
"Damn, I think I need new glasses. I can't see nothing," he says as I hold the ladder steady.
"Want me to look?" I offer.
"Help yourself."
He climbs back down. I take a small magnifying lens from my satchel and up I go. He hands me the light and I examine the eye bolts. I can't see any fibers. If there are any, we are not going to have any luck collecting them here. The problem is how to preserve one type of evidence without ruining another, and there are three possible types of evidence that might be associated with the eye bolts: fingerprints, fibers, and tool marks. If we dust off soot to look for latents, we might lose fibers that could match